Fuchsia enthusiasts, and welcome to a very special live episode of Style Points, recorded as the keynote address at the 2024 Ohio Society of Anesthesiologists meeting. My guest was Dr. Ron Harder, professor of anesthesiology at The Ohio State University and current president of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, which, for our medical students, is the nation's largest organization of physician anesthesiologists. Yes, you heard right. The president of the ASA agreed to be my guest on Style Points. Now, some of you might be wondering, how did I get the president of our national society to agree to be on my podcast? I'm not sure. However, Dr. Harder was very gracious with his time and his answers. Without further ado, live from the OSA, it's Style Points with Ron Harder, ASA president.
My name's John Crow. I've been to this meeting for many years, and about a little less than a year ago, I started a podcast called Style Points. And don't worry, I'm not making any money from this podcast. I don't run any ads. It's primarily to serve as an educational venue for residents, medical students, and sometimes faculty. So if you're interested in podcasts and like listening to things like ACRAC, which I was a featured guest on, you're welcome to take a look through the QR code there or just search for Style Points in your favorite podcast player. Now, when I first talked to Ron about doing the keynote as the program director for this program, I asked him if he wanted to do his own lecture of his choice. And he said, it seems like it'd take a lot of time. I don't really want to do a lecture. So I said, well, what if I just asked you some questions and did it in a podcast format? And he said, you know, that sounds okay. I think I could do that. So here we are. And so we're going to talk to Ron about some of his philosophy on life, leadership, and being the ASA president. Although I wanted to say that this is my own project and it's distinct from anything OSA related. So it's specifically just my podcast that I don't make any money from. So with that caveat out of the way, we'll get started.
So does that mean I'm also not making any money from this? Because I'm not sure I would have signed up for this.
You know, I think that's a fair point. Maybe we can work something out under the table a little bit later.
Yeah, see. Sounds good.
As long as we don't have to put up a disclosure slide. I wonder, to get started, can you just start by sharing a bit about your journey into anesthesiology and what inspired you to pursue the specialty in the first place?
Sure, yeah. When I started into medical school, well, I knew I wanted to be a doctor of some type from like 5 years old on. I don't know what it was, but it just was something I wanted to do, but I didn't know what specialty. And then in medical school, between my first and second year, when I should have been doing research, I worked as a orderly, they called it then, like patient care associate, in a kidney stone treatment center here in Columbus. And so I saw a lot of urologists, and at that time, the shockwave lithotripsy was intense enough that you had to either be a general anesthetic or they were doing a fair number of them under spinals. And so I got to see a lot of urologists and a lot of anesthesiologists, and the anesthesiologists were doing a combination of spinals and generals, and I just was fascinated with what they did. And then as I talked to more and more of them, they all seemed to be very nice, well-adjusted, happy, normal people. And so I said, there might be something to this. So then when I had the opportunity in my third year to do an elective in anesthesiology, I did that, and I was totally hooked and very happy with the decision I made.
So you feel like it was better to intubate from above than from below?
Exactly.
Sort of the decision point there. Makes sense.
Yes, very true.
It seems like becoming ASA president probably takes a lot of time and effort and emails and going to a lot of meetings. One of my residents has shared with me, actually, that she wants to be the president of the ASA someday. For her benefit, how did you get here?
Yeah.
Did you always know you wanted to be the president of our society?
Not necessarily, although I got involved in ASA very early on. As a resident, I was elected to serve on the ASA Resident Component Governing Council, and that gave me a very early insight into ASA, how the organization works, and gave me the opportunity to meet various leaders within ASA who I just was, without exception, really impressed with just their commitment, their dedication, their knowledge. And I said, you know, that's, I would like to be that when I, you know, as I advance in my career. And so, you know, do some level of involvement within ASA as an organization. But you don't necessarily, I don't think, at that early point say this is exactly the path I'm going to be on, but more just how can I be involved and engaged in our specialty society. And then as things progress, then you start to see a path forward where, well, maybe, you know, this next step will take me to another step that I can do that. So it starts taking shape, you know, a few years into that. My advice to your resident would be, I think with very few exceptions, I should say, people who are leaders within ASA, they start with, or concurrently at least, with leadership within their state component. I don't know that, you know, there's 12 officers within ASA. Almost all of them, if not all of us, are former presidents or future presidents of our state components. There's at least one that I know of that'll be president of her state component in another year or so. But that really creates the foundation and the depth of understanding of the issues that we face. And frankly, a lot, as I'll talk about in the ASA update, many of the advocacy issues that we face, payment issues and scope of practice and all those things, those battles are very largely being waged at the state level. And so it's invaluable to be a leader within ASA to bring that experience from what you've learned in the state level.
So can you tell me about some of the most influential experiences that you've had in your career, maybe some that have shaped your leadership style or the way that you approach problems? What are some of those experiences to you?
So in those various leadership roles, I had the opportunity, as I was learning my own leadership style and skills, I learned a lot by the people who were leaders when I was in various roles, sort of moving up the ranks, both within the department as well as within ASA. And I often feel like you might learn more from bad leaders than you do from good leaders, because it gives you a very good example of how did that make me feel when a leader maybe was dismissive or didn't really respect me or whatever. And so I tried to not be the bad leader while, you know, emulating the things in good leaders. So, and again, within ASA specifically, the past presidents that I've had the opportunity to interact with over the years have just been tremendous mentors, and they, you know, have given me invaluable advice of things to prepare me for being president and some of the things to expect, and so that's been just tremendously valuable for me. And then but I think both my leadership at the department level and my leadership within ASA, I think those each complemented each other, because there are some things that are unique to a department that I think you can extrapolate to ASA type of issues, but also things that I've learned within ASA that have helped me with managing a department.
You mentioned some of those bad leaders that you learned a lesson from. I wonder if you could just go ahead and list all of those people.
Give their names, yeah, and I could give you their cell phone numbers.
Yeah,
too.
Right. Yeah. We can go ahead and put them up on the PowerPoint.
Yeah.
So when you came in as president of the ASA, I'm sure with all of your campaigning and everything else, you had some goals for the organization. Can you talk a little bit about what some of those goals that you had for your presidency and for the organization were?
Yeah, great question. So one of the pieces of advice that I got from a past president was and I was, I think, maybe first vice president at the time, so a couple of years ago, was identify maybe one, at most two things that you want to accomplish that are in addition to or additive to the things that you do as president. Because the things you do as president are, there's a lot on that list that you have to do, and you can be very busy, and certainly a lot of your time spent on doing the things that the ASA president needs to do. You do a lot of traveling to especially society meetings. There's a lot of Zoom calls. There's a lot of things that, you know, new legislative issues that come up and scope of practice issues that come up, and that keeps your calendar pretty full. And that's fine if you get through the year and you just have done, you know, checked all the boxes, crossed all the T's and dotted the I's of the things that the president needs to do in that role. But it's a missed opportunity if you don't have some other thing. And so for me, that thing was wellness and having wellness resources for our members. You know, that's something that I've had an interest in for quite a while. And within ASA, there's various efforts that I've been involved in initiatives that I led around wellness. But I felt like there was, ASA had compiled some good resources about that, but there was, I think, more opportunity there. And as I was president-elect, you know, what my dream was, can we provide a service for members where they can access mental health resources? And I didn't know quite exactly what that was, and we initially looked at, can we build something like that within ASA? And to really do that and do it well and to have the appropriate expertise and everything, that was going to be a, you know, really incredibly big lift to try and put all that together. And then as we were having discussions with myself and kind of some other leadership within ASA, both physician as well as ASA staff leadership that have interest in this area, we became aware of this safe haven entity that was started out of the Medical Society of Virginia for physicians to provide confidential counseling, coaching, those types of services. And then as they had really gotten that well established within the Medical Society of Virginia, then they were starting to offer this more broadly to other physician groups. And the American Society of Clinical Oncologists, as this came to our attention, they had just launched a pilot for their members to give them access for a small fee to have access to all those safe haven programs. And so then it was a matter of, you know, how can we provide this for our members? You know, how do we pay for it? Do we ask the members to pay full freight themselves? And that may be fine for an established anesthesiologist, but for somebody who's in training or newly out of practice, you know, as we looked into it, the discounted rate that we got from Safe Haven was $333 a person. And thinking back to my residency days, and you have to pay it all at once, you can't, like, you know, spread it out over a year. So that would have been a heavy lift, certainly for me and my residency. And so we were able to coordinate with our ASA Charitable Foundation that they offset a lot of the costs and then so reduced it by more than half. So for $149, you get all of the resources of Safe Haven. And so we were able to launch that in June. We've got now several people who have signed up. They're still, and I'll talk about this some in the ASA update, but that's something that I, you know, feel very good about, that I was able to identify something and actually get it across the finish line during my presidency. But it required, but the other advice I got is don't wait to your president year to start teeing things up, because by the time you get all of those preliminary things done, you're no longer president and you no longer have that pulpit to preach from and to get those types of things in place.
Physician wellness and taking care of our own is a topic that's gotten more and more popular over time, because I think it's become more and more relevant over time. Increasingly, I think anesthesiologists and other healthcare professionals are all stretched. Burnout is a big issue. I wonder, what have been some of the experiences that you've had in your personal life, in your background, that have influenced sort of your approach towards aiming towards physician wellness as one of your main ideas of focus?
Yeah, great question. When I was a resident, I trained at Georgetown, and it was at the time, it was a pretty small program, and there were like 8 residents in my class, and so everybody knew everybody very well. And during the time, my 3 years in residency at Georgetown, 2 of our chief residents in two successive years had been diverting fentanyl for their own use. And so in a program that size, to have 2 colleagues that experienced that immediately sort of pushed me in a direction of, the impairment issue, and certainly related to that is the stress and the burnout, and they're all definitely intermingled issues. And so then as my career progressed, and I was an officer within ASA, there was a big expose, if you will, in the Washington Post talking about physician suicide, and there were several bullet points, and this was kind of an unscientific, unofficial tally of, not even really a survey, but this physician had been tracking deaths by suicide among physicians, and by her data, male anesthesiologists were the highest group of, of any specialty, especially by gender, of reported death by suicide among physicians. So then that was what prompted ASA to create a committee on physician well-being, and initially it was suicide, and then it kind of rolled into well-being, and I was asked to lead that initiative because I had kind of had some interest in that already, and so that then I think further propelled me into this. And the more that I became aware of the issues over the years, the more that I realized this is really a significant challenge, and it's only gotten worse as far as burnout and so forth over the years. So it's one of those things, I think the more that you are aware of it, the more that you can't just ignore it, and you kind of get pulled into it further.
I appreciate you sharing that. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the success stories that you might have seen about physician wellness through the program that you created.
Yeah, so as far as the program, we're starting to get now some anecdotal reports back. It's, it's by design, people enter it confidentially. So ASA doesn't know who's signed up, but if they want to volunteer to us, feedback of, hey, this was great. So we're starting to hear some of that. We just got a great testimonial recently from somebody about the coaching aspect of it, that it was, they found it tremendously valuable, and they were able to apply a lot of the things that they had learned from their coach, and the coach directed them to some further resources to read on coaching and sort of managing various leadership challenges and things. And so so I think that's an aspect of it that I think is has a I think an appeal that's sort of additive to, or maybe even a little bit separate from the wellness issue, is that even if you feel like my life's great, I have no stress at all, that it's got those kinds of resources. And I've heard some feedback from people just sort of off the record that they've enrolled in Safe Haven, and they have really found it to be a terrific asset and a resource for them. We had a member just, I guess it was last weekend, that called ASA that they were they were sort of contemplating harming themselves and they were directed then to Safe Haven. And this person was not yet signed up with Safe Haven, but we reached out to Safe Haven, and their counselors spoke to this person, and by the time I got in the loop, I talked to him as well, and he was not at a point anymore where he felt like he was at, you know, risk of harming himself. But, you know, so those, yeah, those kinds of things are what's out there. And so, you know, you can't measure, I don't think, what the benefit will be from Safe Haven, but it doesn't take too many of those stories before you say what, you know, it's doing what it's supposed to do.
Absolutely. This is an amazing program, and I would encourage any of you who might be feeling that way to take a look. That's what it's there for. One of the things that you mentioned was coaching, and coaching has been sort of a big buzzword that I was wondering if you could give a little bit of your expertise towards. What's the difference between coaching and mentorship, and how does that all work?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, I think they're very closely related. I think that mentors tend to generally need to be in your same area of expertise, because they can really tell you, you know, here's the opportunity that you ought to pursue that will then put you on the next step of the path that you're wanting to go on. And I know that because that's something that I did myself. Coaching is a little bit more, it can be somebody in your own specialty, but it's more, you know, how do you deal with, you know, I tend to avoid difficult conversations with people, even though I know that that's what needs to be done. How do you get yourself to get to that point, and what are the things that can help you to have those difficult conversations? Or, you know, what are some of the just general leadership challenges around communication or whatever? So it's more broad application of the skills that will make you an effective leader, not necessarily to be, if I aspire to be president of the ASA, what are the steps within ASA I need to take to do that? That's more of a mentor. And certainly, as I referenced, like the past presidents within ASA, those were people who were mentors to me, but not necessarily coaches, you know. So I guess that's what I see as the distinction, but there may be others who have better insight on that than I do.
Walking around here this morning and talking to everybody, there's a lot of residents and medical students and younger faculty that we have here that represent the future of our specialty. And it's really fantastic to see you all here. What I would like us all to benefit from is Dr. Harder's next answer here. What advice do you have for those young anesthesiologists or people who are about to become anesthesiologists in terms of taking leadership roles, in terms of how to best build your career starting right now?
Yeah, great question. So I think that as we've already sort of touched on, having mentors is really important. And notice I said mentors plural. You know, you can't just have a mentor who's going to be expert in you know, every facet of your career that you're going to want to pursue. If you want to be you know, a nationally recognized educator in anesthesiology, that's going to be a different mentor probably than somebody who can advise you on how do I get to be in leadership roles within ASA. So having mentors that you can go to and ask questions of. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've, you know, was kind of slow to learn myself, but it's advice that I give to people when they ask for my input, is you have to be comfortable and learn that you don't have to say yes to everything. Because I think there's, certainly in my own case, anything that anybody said, hey, can you do this? Can you do, you know, whatever it was? Sure, yeah, I can do that. Because I wanted to be viewed as the go-to person who's able to do whatever, solve any problem or work on any project that came along. But it, you know, there the reality is there is a finite number of hours in the day, and there's a finite number of things that you can really do well. And I eventually got to the point where I realized that, the more that I take on, the more that I'm taking away from some of the other things that I've already committed to, not to mention, time, with family and doing something other than work during every waking hour. So, and that's where I think a mentor can be very helpful, because they can help to discern between, you've got a couple opportunities and maybe you take the new opportunity, but to do that, you need to offload some of the things that you're already doing. And I think that's, that was a hard lesson for me to learn, but once I finally recognized that, and you have to have enough self-confidence that I can say no to something and it's not like the faucet will shut off and nobody will ever ask me to do anything ever again. And I think if you give a thoughtful response to it that, gosh, it'd be a great opportunity, but I just, I don't feel like I could commit the time to it, certainly because I've had people, give me that response when I've asked them to do things either in the department or ASA type of things. And I very much respect that answer, and I'd much rather somebody tell me that they don't feel like they have the bandwidth to do it than to, sure, I'll do it, and then, they don't respond to your emails because they're constantly doing other things and they can't commit really fully to what you've asked them to do. So I think that would be probably my single biggest piece of advice is knowing when it's okay to turn down an invitation or an opportunity to do something. You can't do it every time, but if you're judicious about what you do say yes to, I think that'll help you to maintain some level of balance, work life as well as within your career path, that you can stay focused on the things that are really meaningful for your career progression.
Well, I wanted to ask you actually a little bit about work-life balance specifically. Like me, you're a father with a handful of kids.
Five, yeah.
I've just got three, but I think I'm done.
That's a good start.
Me. Yeah. My question for you, though, is how do you balance all that? Five kids plus being ASA president and taking all these projects on, how do you broach these things with your partner? How do you broach these things with your kids? How does it all work together and be balanced?
Yeah, I'd like to say I've always done that perfectly, but I really, looking back, it there were definitely a lot more of those responsibilities fell on my wife, Kathy. I don't know if she's here. I think she'll be here later. But for those of you who know Kathy, she's tireless and just really, if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be able to have committed all of the time and attention that I have to ASA things. But I think that some of the things that I've learned over the years is if you are somebody who really strictly keeps to your Outlook calendar or whatever, for your appointments, schedule in time for I'm going to go see a play with my spouse or go to a movie or we're just going to get out of town for a weekend. Because if you don't do that, then everything else kind of just continues to encroach on that and nibble away at that time that you could be spending with your significant other and with your family. Definitely having a supportive partner is hugely, hugely important. And that's what's, allowed me, frankly, to commit all the time that I have to OSU and ASA.
So start by marrying the right person.
Yes. Absolutely.
That should be easy to do. Good luck to everyone. So, in your view, what are some of the key qualities that make an effective leader in the field of anesthesiology? If somebody is interested in leadership, but they're trying to look inside themselves to see if they have what it takes, what are some of the things that people should either try to cultivate or look for in themselves to be effective leaders within our field?
I think that a lot of the attributes that make a good anesthesiologist also make a good leader. You don't freak out when something goes wrong. Everybody else around you may be freaking out, but a good anesthesiologist is the calm in the middle of the storm, and is able to focus on what's the priority, what do we need to do to get this patient better, and not be distracted by all of the other things that are flying around you. And I think that helps in leadership, because you'll have all kinds of things that will be coming in your email inbox or whatever, and to be able to identify and prioritize, here's what's really important, here's what I have to deal with. I think as anesthesiologists, we interact with many other medical specialties, in particular now that we do so much out of the OR, and I think that gives us helpful perspective and I think recognition and buy-in from other specialties that, 20 years ago, we wouldn't have necessarily had recognition from interventional radiology or gastroenterology or, various other non-OR areas that we're present at now, that I think also helps with things like having a leadership role within your medical staff and things like that, because you're not seen as just the person who's on the other side of the drape in the OR. So I think that, I think that it anesthesiologists are, we kind of self-select for our specialty. And I think people who come into anesthesiology, and also you're not typically somebody who, I have to make sure no matter what, first thing that happens is I get credit for the good things that happen. Because as anesthesiologists, we're typically the ones that are kind of the unsung heroes. And I think that makes a good leader, frankly, when you're more focused on having a positive outcome than how does this reflect positively on me, and how can I spin this, for my own glorification.
That makes a lot of sense. Lastly, I wonder if you can share sort of a memorable moment or maybe a turning point from your tenure as ASA president.
Yeah. I would say for me it was when, going back to the safe haven thing, presenting it to the March board of directors. So ASA, for those of you who don't know inside and out, ASA governance structure like I do, so we have 12 officers, and then there's a board of directors, and every state has a director. So Bassem Abdelmalek, who's probably somewhere in here, yes, raising his hand, he is Ohio's director to the ASA board of directors. So there's 50 plus a few other entities that have a representation on the board of directors, and they really set sort of the fiduciary and largely drive ASA policy and direction. And so I presented to the March board requesting financial support from the board. As I mentioned, the Charitable Foundation was offsetting a lot of that, but ASA had to front, the money for all the subscriptions for these pilot subscriptions, which was not an insignificant amount of money. And anytime you go to the board of directors, who their primary duty is fiduciary responsibility to the organization, when you ask for money, it's always a little bit unnerving as to how that'll be perceived, because every organization has its own financial challenges and priorities and so forth, and this was a new expenditure, and person after person came up from at the board meeting saying how important this was, and validated that was the right thing to be doing, so that it wasn't just my pipe dream, of I think this is important and nobody else in the room thinks it is. So that, to me, that was a big turning point, or big validation for the things that I had been focusing on around the wellness program.
That's fantastic, and we all appreciate you fighting that fight for us. Thank you. Lastly, the title of our talk is Style Points, and what I ask all of my guests on the podcast is what advice you have in terms of what your own personal style points or points of personal preference that you use, whether it's in the operating room or in your leadership roles. What are some of your personal style points that you like to use on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, I think you have to be appropriately self-confident. Before I was president for ASA, I was vice speaker, and then speaker of the House of Delegates. And that's kind of a very early lesson as a parliamentarian, is never let them see you sweat. You know, so I think you better have the stuff to back it up, because if it's just, you know, I'm incredibly confident, but I don't really have any knowledge to back that up, that usually doesn't go very well. But you need to have this sort of air of I've got this, and that tends to instill confidence, and people feel like, okay, this is somebody that I'm comfortable having them, you know, lead the House of Delegates or ASA or the department or whatever. So, but I think you need to also maintain humility, that you can't be an egomaniacal, confident leader. You have to be confident, but, you know, keep your ear to the ground as far as what are the things that people are concerned about, and is there some blind spot that I have? So I think if you can be perceived as approachable, so if people feel like you're going down the wrong path, I would like to know that before you go off the cliff. So it's sort of a combination of I've got this, but if you think there's things that I'm missing, the people feel comfortable sharing that. So that can be a challenge to get that perfectly, but I think that's what I try to do within my leadership style.
Thank you so much for joining us up here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to do this. And if there is some financial gain that, you know, ultimately comes from this, I'll...
I wanted to leave a couple minutes at the end if any of you had questions. I've been asking Ron questions for quite a while now, but if any of you have questions that you wanted to ask our president, then please, David will bring you the microphone.
Thank you very much. What a great talk, Ron. As my chair for 14 years, I have to acknowledge you publicly for your academic support and every time. The question to you, Ron, is what about the future of academic anesthesiology and how you see the ASA helping the specialty with all the difficulty we have financially?
Yeah, great question. The future of academic anesthesiology, certainly I saw firsthand, you know, running an academic department, the financial pressures that academic departments face, and I don't think it's gotten better in the 2 years since I've been, since I stepped down as chair. But, much of what ASA does is around being appropriately paid for our services, and we certainly have not won that battle. But I think that sometimes is perceived within the academic realm as, well, you're only talking about money and you're not talking about research and science. But I feel like if you don't get the financial support for the care that we, payment for the care that we provide and should rightfully be getting, that since we don't get that, then we have to ask for ever increasing support from hospital leadership, and it just creates this dynamic where, you're getting, seven-figure, eight-figure support from the hospital, and then you have the audacity to say, and can we also have a little bit more for research? It really makes a challenging environment. So I think that all the things that we're doing to advocate for better payment for our services, that's also hugely important for academic departments. And I think a lot of our academic departments get that, but I think a lot of them see us, a lot of them see ASA as just, we're kind of a trade union almost, that we're only focused on the dollars when really the dollars are what drive, you know, no margin, no mission, as we all kind of know. So I think getting that, continuing to fight that fight and hopefully, you know, I think we have some initiatives in place that might help, you know, to get more appropriate payment for what we do, I think will help tremendously with the academic mission, because it's, you know, we're all seeing increased pressure of you're in an academic department, but your expectations clinically are not that much different, maybe no different from what it is in private practice. And you're also then expected to be doing the things that an academic anesthesiologist should do around teaching and research and other scholarly activity. So I think until we get better payment for our services, I think that's going to continue to be a challenge. And I think we have to do that first and then, continue to focus on the academic mission, but it's hard to really get to where we need to be without that.
I think we have time for one more question before the business meeting.
Sir, I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming out and talking with us. I'm a fairly new attending, 2 years out of residency, serving military obligation over at Wright-Patt.
Thank you for your service.
Absolutely. I'm kind of witnessing all this stuff, academic, private practice, unfolding of anesthesia, obviously the shortage, and as quote-unquote the future, you know, generation. Unfortunately, a lot of things still seem a bit concerning. Like you touched on, reimbursement continues to go down, stipends need to go up. I've been privy to at least some local changes in the anesthesia dynamic in Dayton, which there's been a lot of case studies over the last couple of years, obviously published even with recent, you know, journal articles, specifically private equity in anesthesia. And I can tell you just from firsthand experience, trying to get some continued experience like you do in residency outside of a military treatment facility forces you to kind of get to know the local area. And so I've worked in private practice, physician-owned hospital contracted groups. I've also worked at some private equity-backed groups that have taken the contract, so to speak, from, you know, a group that have been there 20 years. And the difference is pretty striking to me, to be honest with you. So if you have any time, I know it's a big rabbit hole there, but just kind of talking on maybe the ASA's, you know, perception and what we can do to hopefully, you know, not let the physician entrepreneurship die as it appears to be doing currently.
Yeah, great question. It's a huge issue and huge concern. So ASA has so we have various resources for, you know, privately held groups of, you know, how to make your pitch, if you will, to the C-suite, because I think a lot of instances where that, you know, private equity or whatever, or some other large entity, private equity backed or not, has kind of displaced a privately held group. Not always, but there's some instances where if the leadership of that group could have had a, you know, better equipped to have conversations with the C-suite and maybe correct some of the misconceptions that they have, because I think there's a lot of hospital executives that have learned the hard way that we thought anesthesia was expensive before, and now, you know, you've displaced this group that was there for decades, and now you've got locums coming and going that are really charging way more than what you thought was too much before. So I think that's one thing, and we've reassembled a group because of the changing market and how things are changing so rapidly and all the pressures that are coming to bear on groups of various sizes, that to make sure we're giving the best possible toolkit to people to be able to, you know, continue to have those good conversations with their hospital leadership. Private equity is a concern, but I think it's not correct to say that if private equity went away tomorrow, all of our problems would be over. It's because of the gap between what we get paid and what it costs to provide that service, you know, that's what creates, I think, the challenging dynamic, where then it puts increasing pressure on, well, this other group can do it cheaper, but the group that's doing it cheaper, are they providing the same quality and the same, level of care that's being provided by the, by the current group. So, it's a concern, but it's not just private equity, I would say. And so I think as we get, if we can do better with getting paid appropriately for what we do, that's going to help with that. And I think the for the private equity standpoint, even if ASA marshaled all its forces and said, we're going to get private equity out of anesthesia, that's not something ASA has the ability to do. The Department of Justice and various other federal entities are, I think, looking at, what are the aspects of private equity investing that drive the quality of care in a negative direction that diverts money that should be going either to providers or improving patient care that gets diverted to the investors as opposed to staying within the healthcare realm. So it's a complex issue, but I think the biggest thing ASA can do is help to have resources for our members to be able to continue to demonstrate their value that they provide. And I think there's some examples of some really failed takeovers that as those are communicated amongst hospital executives, hopefully I'm going to go with the quick, easy fix here and pay less for anesthesia services by using this other entity, whatever it may be, that they're going to recognize that it's maybe not quite such a simple fix as what it's portrayed as by whoever's approaching them for their with their pitch.
Well, I think we're about out of time and we need to move on to the business meeting, but thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
That's it for this episode of Style Points. I'd like to sincerely thank Dr. Harder for joining me. Hopefully, some of his answers were as inspirational to you as they were to me. If you liked this episode, feel free to subscribe or leave us a rating or a review. That helps other people find the podcast too. For the first time at the OSA meeting, someone I didn't know came up to me, a medical student from Northwestern, and said that he realized halfway through this lecture that I was the Style Points guy. That was pretty cool. Thanks again for listening. And lastly, take a deep breath, open your eyes, we're all done.